Closed captioning for AutoLine Detroit is brought to you by Virtual Services Automotive Specialists.
Hello, I'm John McElroy. Welcome to AutoLine Detroit, the television program for, of, and about the automotive industry. On today's show, we're going to revisit a bit with the guest that we've had on for the last 2 weeks. Due to popular demand, we're going to show more of my interviews with Bob Lutz from General Motors and with Buzz Hargrove, the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union. I know a lot of you have gone to our website to see some of those extra parts of those interviews. In fact, so many of you went there, it crashed our system. We apologize for that, and we're working feverishly on a new website with more bandwidth that ought to be ready in a number of weeks. But what you'll see on today's show was not available on our website. Then we're also going to take a look at the newest vehicle in Hyundai's lineup, that sharp little crossover called the Veracruz. But before we get to all that, I want to take a minute to look at all the action that took place this past week in Washington, D.C. about raising fuel economy standards. You know, I'm getting sick and tired of hearing all these politicians talking about how the American automakers just don't get it and praising foreign automakers as being so much better at fuel economy. The fact of the matter is that in Europe right now, gasoline is about $7 a gallon. In Japan, it's over $5 a gallon. That's because they tax their fuel a lot more than we do. Well, what kinds of cars and trucks do you think Americans would be buying if gasoline cost $7 a gallon? We wouldn't need any fuel economy regulations. And in fact, Europe doesn't have them because they don't need them. People just buy fuel-efficient cars thanks to the high price of fuel. American politicians are taking cheap shots against Detroit because they don't have the guts to raise our fuel prices. It's far easier to blame Detroit than to risk the wrath of voters. And I'll have more to say about that at the end of the show. But in the meantime, stay right where you are because we've got a lot coming up on AutoLine Detroit.
Production of AutoLine Detroit is brought to you by
Quieter, stronger, safer, better. At Dow Automotive, we're all about solutions. Solutions that perform. From Dow Automotive, we listen, we deliver.
We know the value of innovation. We push the boundaries of technology to produce the next generation of modules and components for light vehicle systems and commercial vehicles. At Arvin Meritor, we're passionate about delivering value, quality, and performance. We learn innovation young. Arvin Meritor, solutions that move the world.
When it comes to advanced energy solutions, Michigan has more power.
Any other state would be hard-pressed to match the work that MEDC has done.
In an effort to recharge Michigan's economy, high-tech companies like Cobasys can expect to find everything they need to be successful, like the 21st Century Jobs Fund, a tech-savvy talent pool, and so much more.
They've been with us all along. They've helped us find this facility. They've helped us grow our business. They've been a wonderful partner.
Let the Michigan Economic Development Corporation give your business the upper hand.
A global innovation network enables your organization to capture ideas from every part of the value chain and quickly turn great ideas into great products. UGS delivers a system that links all your partners in a real-time network where each can impact the conception, launch, lifecycle, and long-term financial success of your product. UGS solutions power your global innovation network.
The American Iron and Steel Institute and its member companies are committed to a vital and sustainable North American steel industry. AISI, accelerating innovation with advanced high-strength steel.
Straight from the Motor City, this is AutoLine Detroit. Here's veteran automotive journalist John McElroy.
First up today is Buzz Hargrove of the CAW. We join that interview as he talks about the problems he sees with free trade.
The Koreans would say that you're already in their market because GM owns Daewoo. And in fact, a lot of Koreans feel that they were taken advantage of, that GM came in and picked the bones over one of their big, great companies and got a fabulous company, almost free. Now they're building millions of cars there.
Remember, General Motors is going in. It rescued Daewoo, but it rescued it based on the same strategies that the Japanese and the Koreans have been following for years. That is, build in Korea and ship to North America. That's how they're making their money. Same thing as Japan. You can go into Japan, as Ford did with Mazda. But you can't go into Japan to say we're going to build cars by Mazda and Ford in the U.S. and sell them in Japan. You can go into Japan and build Mazdas by Ford and Mazda and sell them in the United States, but not reverse. It's a closed market. They are taking unfair advantage. Less than 50% of vehicles in the first quarter of this year in the United States sold were built by someone other than GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler. The three companies who provide 80% of the investment in the U.S. auto industry and the Canadian auto industry buy 80% of the parts from manufacturers where the content is incredible. Toyota, I believe, creates about 57 jobs for each vehicle they sell in the United States, compared to almost 100 by the other three, GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler. So it's a huge impact on working people in both our countries.
Well, yeah, I'll challenge you on one thing. You know, BMW and Mercedes-Benz have almost the same market share in Japan as they do in the U.S. Now, you have to exclude the little 660cc, what they call K cars in Japan. But it seems to me that if you really stick to it, if you really go at it, you can sell cars in Japan.
It's interesting. You sound like one of the Iga Mattel people on the supervisory board made the argument with me. We sell 50,000 Mercedes. You can sell Mercedes and Rolls Royces and Bentleys in Japan because the people who buy them will pay the penalty to get them in the country for sale. But you can't sell anything mass-produced, whether it's in Germany or in the United States, in Japan. It's only the wealthy that get what they want in that country. The average consumer has absolutely no choice to buy a GM, Ford, or Chrysler-built product.
But the other argument is that we don't build much that they want to buy.
Well, you know, Toyota, I get that argument once in a while, but look at Toyota and Honda. They got plants in the United States and Canada. If the argument is that GM, Ford, and Chrysler don't know what they're doing after over 100 years building vehicles, surely Toyota, Honda, Nissan are building here. They could sell them back home, couldn't they? Mm-hmm. You know why they don't? Because they won't allow them to.
Oh, they can't export them back from the...
There was over 800,000 vehicles shipped from South Korea, and given some of them are Daewoo, which is owned by General Motors, but both were Hyundai, Kia, and others, while there was less than 8,000 vehicles that were built in North America shipped into South Korea. Now, is that, if you want that kind of trading relationship, it means you're going to have a lot less jobs. Why is it we're closing plants, taking off shifts, throwing thousands of workers out of work, not hiring, no opportunities for our young people, but in these countries, they're all hiring, adding plants, adding shifts, great opportunities for young people. Who's the smartest?
Well, you can cherry pick on both the CAW and UAW side, plants that are brilliantly run, high quality, high productivity, but then there are others where very high absenteeism daily, lots of work rules, especially with the skilled trades and the like. So, I mean, there's both sides to it.
But it's the same union in all the plants in Canada, and it's the same union and all the plants in the United States. So where is the problem? Is it with the union? Of course not. Okay, if it was, why would we have these highly productive plants and one that's not so highly productive? It's the management, local management. There's a lot of things that are happening, but they're also happening in the Japanese plant. You know, the Japanese, the recalls are the thing that frustrates me. Toyota and Honda have had over 9 million recalls in the last two or three years. Yeah, you could barely read about it unless you want to read the major...
The media does not treat it.
Well, that's changed, at least in this country in the last year. There's been a lot of attention put on the sludge problems Toyota's had with its engines. It's happening. Maybe not. Certainly not to the degree that the big three command the headlines when they have a problem.
Yeah, and those are the bigger problems than our union contracts. I don't know of a union contract that inhibits the companies from building product quality or having a productive plan. If they are, and the union doesn't change them, then there's something pretty silly going on.
The UAW seems to be making a run now at Toyota to try to get it organized. They failed trying to do the same with Nissan and Honda. You think they have any chance, or do you have any chance
of
getting
know.
Them?
I don't know. And again, organizing is not only about organizing the plant. Organizing is about making sure that Toyota meets the same standards as the unionized facilities are making. So if they accomplish that, that takes away the major advantage that Toyota has by paying some workers $14, $15 an hour versus $27 in the UAW plant. That's been our success. The auto companies that raise that, they can't look at a plant in Canada and say, well, they have an unfair advantage on labor cost. They don't, other than things we have no control, which is new hires and the cost that I outlined earlier.
But does Toyota use a lot of temporary temporary employees in their plant in Ontario. That's one.
Yes, they use temporary employees. That may or may not be an advantage. I'm not sure what they pay those. I hadn't even thought about it until you raised it, Joe. But I will check that.
This climate change issue is fast approaching, coming down on the industry. What's the CAW's position on that? Do you have a formal position on climate change?
Yes. I mean, this is one of the major concerns we're facing today, because it's the politicians in our country. I mean, everybody's tripping over one another to chase and become this new god of the environment. Now, people that never knew how to spell the word are now saying, we got the solution, we got the answer. And it's very, very worrisome. We have four provinces now that are either passed legislation or have legislation pending that will restrict our ability to sell what we build in Ontario in those provinces, because they won't meet the emission standards or the fuel efficiency requirement that they have. And the same thing's happening in the U.S. But it's interesting to say, as I watch the U.S., countries like California and Vermont and Utah, it's like British Columbia, Quebec, Nova Scotia, and Manitoba, don't have an auto industry. They don't have to worry about losing the industry or the jobs. All they worry about is satisfying the environmental movement, which is very, very strong, very effective in our country, and obviously they are here. So we have these getting us in a situation where 90% of what we produce in Ontario will not be able to be sold in some of these provinces if they introduce these standards. It's insane when you look at it. So we're arguing, yes, there has to be a solution found, and we should all get around the table and come up with a workable solution that's intelligently designed, and recognize we didn't get in this problem overnight, and it's going to take us a period of time to work our way out of it. When our three companies that we deal with, that provide, again, 80% of the investment in jobs, are losing billions of dollars, don't force something on them, firstly, that they can't pay for, and secondly, it's not clear that the technology is there to allow them to do it even if they had the money. But having said that, I'm not worried about GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler. They will survive. They may all be Asian or Eastern European corporations, and there won't be many jobs in North America. I'm worried about what happens to their workers and their families and communities in North America. That's key for the future. We can't accept the logic of the environmentalists and those who are driving this agenda. You can't do this overnight.
Coming up next, we're going to take a look at the newest vehicle in Hyundai's lineup, the Veracruz. Just how confident is Hyundai with its newest crossover, the Veracruz? Enough so that at the media introduction, Hyundai let journalists have a head-to-head competition with the Veracruz versus the Lexus RX 350. While ultimately the Veracruz fell a little short of the Lexus, it's not that far off the mark. Though Hyundai benchmarked the Lexus, its primary competition really is the Toyota Highlander and Honda Pilot. And this vehicle is built on its own platform, not a car-based one. The exterior design of the Veracruz is similar to the RX 350, but it's a bit blander and doesn't seem to scream the same level of quality that the Lexus does. Inside, the Veracruz is fairly spacious with good amounts of head and leg room. And thanks to a standard third row seat, it can seat up to 7 passengers. The fit and finish is well done, but some of the materials, like the wood grain that runs along the dash, suffer in quality when compared to the Lexus. Like all Hyundais, the Veracruz received high marks in NHTSA's crash ratings. Safety equipment such as 6 airbags, ABS, active head restraints, and ESC are all standard. And convenience features like adjustable power paddles, rain-sensing wipers, rear DVD entertainment, and, well, you get the picture, almost everything's available. The Veracruz shares the same 3.8-liter V6 with the Azera, but it's tuned differently. This is also the first Hyundai to feature a 6-speed automatic transmission. The Veracruz gets pretty good fuel economy, which is pretty much the same as its competitors. Hyundai has placed the Veracruz at the top of its SUV lineup in front of the Tucson and Santa Fe, and the pricing reflects that. A base model starts at nearly $27,000, while a fully loaded Veracruz with all-wheel drive pushes the price just past $38,000. In the future, expect to see more upscale products like the Veracruz to come from Hyundai. So even though it doesn't quite live up to the Lexus, for a starting price that's $12,000 less, does it really matter?
Straight from the Motor City, this is Autoline Detroit. Here's veteran automotive journalist John McElroy.
Next up is the continuation of my interview with Bob Lutz, where he's commenting on the kinds of cars that they have in China versus the ones that they sell here. Here's a question that we got from a viewer who signs off as a Ming staff member of GMInsiderNews.com. And this guy's question is, hey, what about that Chinese Park Avenue, which these are Buick fanatics. They love the thing. And they say, ask Mr. Lutz to compare the reaction to the Chinese Park Avenue to the Super LaCrosse and the Lucerne that don't seem to be having quite the generation of excitement.
Well, in the first place, the Super and the Lucerne Super are simply some additional trim, and in case of the LaCrosse, an additional powertrain to sort of generate some interest in the mid-cycle of the product. They're nowhere near the statement that the Park Avenue makes. The Park Avenue in China is, of course, not the Chinese Park Avenue. It is the Holden Park Avenue. And the original plan was actually to, about 4 years ago, we had that in the product plan as one of the global rear-wheel drive architecture cars to be produced in the United States. I think we showed it to some sort of Buick dealer product marketing council, and the clay model sat next to a Lucerne clay model, and they said, well, what's that one? Well, that one's front-wheel drive, I see. And what's that one? Well, that one's rear-wheel drive. Well, they're sort of the same size. Well, no, that one's actually a little bigger. And they said, well, I don't think we need them both. And since we were looking for capital to cut, we cut the large rear-wheel drive car. There is some interest, and now I'm hearing from many Buick dealers who say, I wasn't part of that meeting.
It wasn't me.
Yeah. And so we are studying the, it's got a low-volume import. We'd probably price it substantially above the Lucerne to create some daylight in the two and reestablish a Buick flagship, because I'll tell you, in terms of ride and handling and interior appointments, I mean, it would return Buick to truly to the luxury class where Buick actually belongs.
By the same token, you have the SLS there in Shanghai with the stretch on the STS wheelbase. And are you looking at that for the States? A great interior.
We did take a look at duplicating that vehicle in the United States. And since we designed that car, the lateral side impact or side impact legislation has greatly increased in severity. So if we did it, we'd have to completely re-engineer it to comply with the latest standards. And that is so much money that it would not pay out, wouldn't even begin to pay out in the remaining life of the STS SLS.
Would you have the flexibility at Grand River to do a long wheelbase?
You know, I don't know that. I honestly don't know. I would say I think so, because when we looked at investment, I don't think there was a great deal of plant investment. But I'm not going to pronounce it.
Usually long wheelbase is easy to do. It's wider that's hard to do.
Yeah. You'd have to ask Gary on that. But it was basically financially unfeasible.
With the global architectures, you're rolling those out. And in a lot of cases, your success right now is with vehicles that predate the global architecture. A lot of the Daewoo models haven't yet made it into. So the success of them, you incorporated things you found at Daewoo that you hadn't thought of at General Motors, at Wuling, where we just were in China. I mean, the beauty of that is there's $100 labor in that, and they're resisting any attempts for anyone to make that any higher.
Yeah.
How do you come up with the one size sort of can be built anywhere with some variations architecture and not squelch what made Daewoo and what made Wuling the success for you so far in the Chevy brand?
Well, they're going to, just to show you how Daewoo benefits, they have introduced the Saturn Sky in Korea, and they'll take it as an import, probably at low volume, but this is something that the first Korean company ever to offer a two-seat roadster in the Korean market would not have been possible without the GM affiliation. And then what's doing very good is the Daewoo Windstorm, which is their version of the Chevy Captiva, architecturally very closely related to the Saturn, the new Saturn Vue and the Opel Antara. So and as we reduce the overall, the global investment, don't forget we don't measure these things by region anymore. What we do is we have a global capital budget for an architecture, which then gets spent in various places, and a global engineering budget. And as long as that total investment and total engineering budget is less, way less than the sum of everybody doing it themselves, the way we used to do it, all of the entities in GM are ahead.
Bob, this will probably have to be the last question, but I'm wondering, is there anything you feel you've got yet left to do in your career? I mean, you've been at more car companies than any other executive I know. You've accomplished more in your life than anybody I know. Anything left to do, or any ticket yet you've got yet to be punched?
Yeah, I think what, you mean beyond being a vice chairman
whatever,
of General Motors?
Whatever,
well, I'm certainly not going to go into politics. I really haven't given that any thought because right now the plan is to stay at General Motors as long as my health permits and as long as Rick Wagner and the board will tolerate me. And I suppose the number one, my number one goal is to see the GM turnaround complete. I really want to, I would feel bad about leaving before the company is manifestly successful again in terms of volume, you know, stable market share at around a quarter of the market. And highly profitable and gaining traction all over the world. Then the culture of what is it that produces that, which is the culture of focusing primarily on the vehicle and on the customer. And the focus is on great vehicles. If you do great vehicles of superb style and, you know, obviously wonderful reliability and quality and everything, then the numbers will follow. And we really have to complete the transition from the history of the company has been maybe the last 30 years was very analytical and assuming that the product guys would take care of the product. And the focus has now shifted to where the top of the company is acutely focused on product excellence as the number one driver in the company. With the faith that if you do that well, financial reward will be yours. But I just want to be sure that cultural DNA is firmly and permanently implanted in the company.
I hope you enjoyed that extra bit with Bob Lutz. Coming up next, I'm going to have some closing thoughts.
Production of Autoline Detroit is brought to you by...
Quieter, stronger, safer, better. At Dow Automotive, we're all about solutions, solutions that perform. From Dow Automotive, we listen, we deliver.
We know the value of innovation. We push the boundaries of technology to produce the next generation of modules and components for light vehicle systems and commercial vehicles. At Arvin Meritor, we're passionate about delivering value, quality, and performance. We learn innovation young. Arvin Meritor, solutions that move the world.
When it comes to advanced energy solutions, Michigan has more power.
Any other state would be hard-pressed to match the work that MEDC has done.
In an effort to recharge Michigan's economy, high-tech companies like Cobasys can expect to find everything they need to be successful, like the 21st Century Jobs Fund, a tech-savvy talent pool, and so much more.
They've been with us all along. They've helped us find this facility. They've helped us grow our business. They've been a wonderful partner.
Let the Michigan Economic Development Corporation give your business the upper hand.
A global innovation network enables your organization to capture ideas from every part of the value chain and quickly turn great ideas into great products. UGS delivers a system that links all your partners in a real-time network where each can impact the conception, launch, life cycle, and long-term financial success of your product. UGS solutions power your global innovation network.
The American Iron and Steel Institute and its member companies are committed to a vital and sustainable North American steel industry. AISI, accelerating innovation with advanced high-strength steel.
Before we close out today's show, I want to go back to the topic of fuel economy regulations that I talked about at the beginning of the show. The politicians look like they've decided to force the auto industry to raise the average fuel economy of cars and trucks from about 25 miles a gallon today to 35 by the year 2020. But they're doing nothing about fuel prices or driver behavior. You know what will happen when vehicles become much more fuel efficient, but the price of gasoline remains relatively steady? You'll make it a lot cheaper for people to drive their cars. And you know what that will do? It will encourage people to drive their cars more. That's exactly what happened with the current fuel economy regulations. Even though they were far stricter than what's being proposed today and called for a 50% improvement in fuel economy, we're using more oil today than ever before. And I think that's exactly what will happen all over again. Anyway, that wraps up this show. For all of us here at AutoLine Detroit, I'm John McElroy. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next week.
Closed captioning for AutoLine Detroit is brought to you by Virtual Services, Automotive Specialists.